Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of Bernie Sanders' challenge last night after losing the New Jersey, New Mexico, South Dakota and California primaries that he will take the fight to the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and author of The Bern Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream, joins us to discuss Bernie Sanders' defiant non-concession speech following Hillary Clinton's victory speech and whether the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia will be a scripted coronation and infomercial as recent conventions have been, or will we return to the 1960s and 1970s when delegations fought it out on the floor before the winner's final acceptance speech? Then we'll look into apparent efforts underway to unify the Democratic Party, starting with Bernie Sanders meeting with President Obama on Thursday, and speak with Lawrence Jacobs, the Walter and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Science and the Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School for Political Affairs at the University of Minnesota. The author of Class War, Economic Inequality, and the American Dream, he joins us to discuss the need for the Democrats to cut back on the number of superdelegates, which the Republicans don't have, although many Republicans who want to stop Trump wish they did. Then finally, we will assess the visit of India's Prime Minister Modi to the White House and his address to a joint session of Congress and discuss the differences between the uncritical embrace of the controversial leader in the United States compared to his critics at home, many of whom see him as a dangerous and divisive figure. Sumit Ganguly, the chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University, joins us to discuss the U.S. effort to enlist India in building up its naval presence in the Indian Ocean to counter the growing global reach of China. And joining us now is Will Bunch, who is an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he blogs at Attitude, that's spelled ATTYTOOD.com. He's the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortions of the Reagan Legacy, and his latest book is The Bern Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Bunch.
Yeah, hi, Ian. Thanks so much for having me back on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Will. And what do you think is going to happen on Thursday at the White House when Bernie Sanders meets with President Obama? Because Obama, of course, probably wants to endorse Hillary Clinton as soon as possible and get on with campaigning against Donald Trump. So what do you think is going to happen there at that meeting?
Well, sure. I mean, I think President Obama sees this as a potential huge win-win for his presidency, and in his mind, for the country. You know, if he can bring about democratic unity. I mean, he has really President Obama has really committed himself to defeating Donald Trump in a way that I've never seen in my lifetime from an incumbent president. You know, not just campaigning for Hillary Clinton or campaigning for the Democratic Party or for his legacy, but really in explicit terms telling voters that he feels that Donald Trump will be a danger to the nation. And so as part of that effort, I think he feels strongly that he wants Bernie Sanders to get behind Clinton's candidacy, and I think he wants Bernie Sanders to play a role in convincing his millions of voters, you know, many of them young people who are participating in the political process for possibly the first time, to not be discouraged by his defeat, but to get on board with the Clinton campaign.
Well, based upon what happened last night at Bernie's non-concession speech in Santa Monica, that's going to be a tough sell, because when Bernie Sanders said to his audience that he had a very gracious call from Secretary Clinton and congratulated her on her victories, the crowd booed. So maybe they're very partisan crowd in that particular case. But my sense is that a lot of Bernie's people aren't too thrilled with Hillary.
Right. Well, he's got to walk a real tightrope in a couple of ways. One way is that, I mean, you're absolutely correct. I mean, the course of this campaign has just created huge animosity between the two camps. I mean, I go on Twitter and I see it every day, just the, you know, backbiting between the Clinton supporters and the Bernie Sanders supporters. And, you know, that's really built to a crescendo pitch. And the issues I found in the campaign, I mean, many of the people who support Bernie Sanders are supporting him because they believe that Hillary Clinton is part of a corrupt system, you know, that's her legacy, that they want to get big money out of politics, and they see Hillary Clinton as emblematic of somebody who raises millions of dollars from large corporate donors. So, you know, it's going to be very difficult for them. I think what Sanders wants to do, because I do think his ultimate desire is two things. One is he wants to defeat Donald Trump, and he knows that Hillary Clinton, for whatever's happened over the last 6 months, is the only legitimate vehicle for beating Trump. And so he is going to look for some way to get his movement, at least in terms of casting their votes in November, behind Clinton, I believe. I believe that's where he's headed. But the other reason he's walking a tightrope is he has some goals that we've come not to expect from our presidential candidates. You know, in the last 20, 30, 40 years, political presidential campaigns have been largely an ego-driven affair. It's about, you know, how you personally can win, and when you reach that point in the campaign where it's clear that the delegate math isn't there and you can't win, you're expected to drop out, because that was the whole point, was to get delegates. Bernie Sanders and his supporters see themselves as conducting a political revolution. They want to bring social change. They have an impressive laundry list of policies that they want to see implemented and pushed for. That includes the $15 minimum wage. That includes banning fracking and other measures that would, you know, put climate change on the front burner. That includes getting rid of big money in politics, somehow overturning the Citizens United court ruling. They're still looking for ways to push these things. And that's where the convention comes in. I mean, there's been talk for months of, you know, fighting on the floor, possibly, if necessary, in the convention to push for these items on the Bernie Sanders agenda. And the question is, can you do that if you've withdrawn your candidacy as a presidential candidate? And I don't think, you know, it's been so long since we've had a real contested convention in this country. I'm not sure people have figured out how this works, you know. I mean, there's other things they want, too. They also want to change the rules of the Democratic Party. There's been so much unhappiness in the campaign about these superdelegates who aren't elected and, you know, have enormous sway in picking the nominee. And, in fact, we saw this week it was superdelegates who gave Clinton finally the votes to put her over the top. Now, I think she would have won anyway because of her lead in pledged delegates, but in the way the current system now, it certainly appears that the superdelegates have way too much influence in swinging the race.
Sure. Well, of course, as I pointed out in the opening, there's a huge irony here that just as the Democrats are considering getting rid of superdelegates, the Republicans wish they had them, at least the Republicans who want to get rid of Donald Trump.
Right. I mean, even now, there are still Republicans who are trying to figure out, can we, you know, maybe change the rules in Cleveland? I mean, there's been, you know, not to go off on a Republican tangent, but I mean, there's been so much unhappiness on that side about Trump's recent actions, such as his comments about Judge Curiel, that there are a few Republicans now who are looking at, is there some way that we can overturn the will of the voters? So you're seeing these conversations on both sides. And it's, you know, it's a fascinating conversation. I mean, what is the actual role of a political party? I mean, are they just there to count the primary votes and their supporters? Or, you know, can elites within these parties intervene, essentially, when it looks like the nominating process has gone haywire and is producing somebody who's counterproductive?
Sure.
I mean,
let me again remind the audience that I'm speaking with Will Bunch, who's an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he blogs at attitude.com. That's attitywtood.com, and he's the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy, and his latest book is The Burn Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. So you're there in Philadelphia, Will, and they're getting ready for the convention, and do you think that Bernie's vow last night to take the fight all the way to the convention Does that mean that we're going to have what you're talking about? Not so much of long infomercial and coronation, but a kind of rowdy contest? I mean, first of all,
That's a great question. I mean, there's two ways to look at this. One is what happens inside the arena, the Wells Fargo Center, where the convention is going to take place. And the other question is kind of what happens out in the streets. It's hard to say what's going to happen inside the convention. I mean, obviously, Hillary Clinton and her supporters have the majority of the delegates. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who at least as of last time I checked, is still the chairman of the chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee, is not a big fan of Bernie Sanders. So, it's going to be hard for them to raise issues on the convention floor. That's why I think we've seen a lot of talk, and I guess it's been a bigger issue here in Philadelphia maybe than outsiders may realize, but there are a number of requests by Bernie Sanders, not his campaign so much, but his affinity groups, independent groups that are supporting Bernie Sanders, who want to have large-scale marches and rallies, from City Hall to the Wells Fargo Center, which is about 3 or 4 miles away in South Philadelphia. Talk of having rallies in FDR Park, which is a large park in close vicinity to the Wells Fargo Center, that might draw, according to the permit applications, 30, 40, 50,000 people. This obviously would not be unprecedented because, as you mentioned at the outset, you saw large crowds and protests, especially at the conventions in the 60s and 70s, but even to a lesser extent in more recent conventions, there have been large crowds and large protests outside. But this, the Sanders people have been talking about doing this on a scale larger than anything we've seen before. I mean, what's interesting, though, is, so much of the planning, so much of the motivation and drive for these marches happened at a time when those people expected that Bernie Sanders would somehow, in some way, still be fighting for the nomination. After he suffered this crushing defeat in California on Tuesday in particular, because I think that was his kind of last rationale for fighting on, and, basically losing California in a landslide, I think was it 12 or 13 percentage points, I don't think he's going to be fighting on as an active candidate in July. And then that raises the question of what about all these people who've been making plans for months of coming here, and are they going to somehow shift gears, or are they going to still have these marches for a candidate who's not really fighting for the nomination anymore? It's a fascinating question. I can't even predict how it's going to play out right now.
Well, of course, one could predict on inside the convention that the minute that Debbie Wasserman Schultz gavels the convention to order, she'll be booed roundly, I think. No doubt.
He's going to have 1,700 or 1,800 delegates
right,
inside
right.
that convention hall. Right.
Right.
No, absolutely.
And then whatever happens outside, of course, I would be more concerned if I were a Republican about what's going to happen outside their convention in Cleveland, because Cleveland is an open carry state. And some of Trump's rowdy supporters, Lewandowski himself, the campaign manager, organized a rally up in New Hampshire where his Tea Party supporters showed up with assault rifles. So
exactly, and you have groups like Bikers for Trump and whatnot. And I wonder. I think this is a fluid situation, as they call it, in that, look at the large protests we've seen in the last week outside of Trump's rallies in San Diego and in Albuquerque and up in Oakland. I don't know what the security situation is going to be like exactly, but I think that could be magnified in Cleveland. So, it goes back and forth about whether Cleveland's going to be the city where you might see unrest or whether it's going to be Philadelphia. But I would right now think that, there's more anger about Trump's nomination than there may be on the Democratic side when July actually rolls around. So I think you could see more security issues there. I mean, just getting back to what's going to happen in Philadelphia with Sanders, I just wanted to mention, I do think the next few days are critical because I think, Bernie Sanders has the most leverage until he drops out and, possibly endorses Hillary Clinton or not. And I think when you think about the things he's going to look for, he's going to want to be able to speak to the convention and speak on national TV in a major primetime slot. if he can. You know, he's going to want to be able to go to his people and say, you know, we got certain things in the platform, like we got the $15 minimum wage, or we got a promise to kick big money out of politics. Or, you know, he might be able to want to say maybe off the record that, you know, he helped nudge Debbie Wasserman Schultz out the door. So I think with this meeting with President Clinton on Thursday, and I think in the discussions that are going to take place between now and the end of this week, you know, if Bernie Sanders plays the cards that he's been dealt, he's going to be pushing for these concessions right now, because I think as time goes on, he's going to have less and less leverage, unfortunately.
Right, but if you followed Hillary Clinton's victory speech last night, point by point, in many ways, was stuff that Bernie's brought to the table.
Right, and that you're absolutely right, and that could minimize whether there really needs to be a platform fight. I mean, I could see a scenario where the Clinton people say, "Okay, you want X, Y, and Z in the platform? Okay, you've got it," because you know, she's migrated during this primary campaign towards those positions anyway. And B, they may say, well, it's just the platform. It's not like she's obligated to follow it once she's a campaign. I mean, I think that's the conundrum for Bernie Sanders and his supporters. I mean, I think they feel like they, by putting pressure on Hillary Clinton, they were able to get her to move to the left on issues like the Keystone Pipeline and on some of these trade deals like the PPP. I did it. Trump did it last night, so he's got me doing it now. Like the TPP. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so the question is, what happens the second you lose that leverage? You know, the primaries are over. How can they make sure that they can keep the pressure on Hillary Clinton to keep her supporting progressive causes? Because the fear is that with the general election coming, you know, she's going to start trying to woo Trump supporters. She's going to move to the right. And that would really alienate the Bernie Sanders nation if that happens.
Well, of course, I think talk of the platform, I find that a bit amusing in a way, because who in the hell ever has cared about a platform at the end of the day? Does a president wake up in the morning and make a decision on domestic or foreign policy issues based upon the platform? It's sort of a bit of a red herring, isn't it?
It's changing times. I mean, a lot of, in the old days, these used to be proxy wars for something else. I mean, there was a huge fight at the 68 Democratic Convention in Chicago over the Vietnam and what the platform was going to say about that. You know, in the 70s, you know, when Ronald Reagan and the more conservative wing of the party was taking over from Gerald Ford and the others in the more liberal wing of the Republican Party, they did fight over issues like abortion, the platform, and they felt that was something. It was just part of the fight. It gave them momentum. And, you know, times have changed so much. I don't know. Remember, Bernie Sanders has been around since those days. He remembers those fights and that they had meaning. But do they mean as much in 2016? I guess we'll find out in Philadelphia. It's hard to say. But I do think that Bernie Sanders, you know, believes now, and he's going to still be believing in July, that he's the leader of a political revolution, and that he's looking to fight that revolution on any front that's possible. And the platform is a front. Is it a front that has a lot of meaning? I don't know. But I think he wants to show that he's not giving up, that his commitment to you know, issues like living wage for workers, you know, like Medicare or health care for all Americans, that he's not going to give up his commitment to those issues just because he didn't get enough delegates to get the nomination.
Well, and think the American people who, for the first time, have heard ideas that are quite common in other social democracies around the world, because we have such a narrow spectrum of political engagement in this country. It's largely slanted to the right and to the center, and Bernie Sanders has opened up the whole left. So I don't think you can put that toothpaste back in the tube. I think this is the great contribution that he's made. Is that these issues have resonated. It's very clear, and they're not going to go away.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, you know, we've always felt that there's more support for things like single-payer health care than our politicians were ready to acknowledge. And I think he's gone out there and proved that to some extent. And, you know, but I think I think he doesn't want to give up. I think he wants to keep that momentum going into Philadelphia somehow. But this is something that we haven't seen in decades. So his struggle this week is he's trying to figure out how to do that. How do you keep your influence when you have, well, he has a large number of delegates, but he's clearly not going to have the majority of delegates. So how does he keep that influence going?
Well, Will Bunch, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian. I really appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Will Bunch, who is an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he blogs at attitude.com. That's spelled ATTYTOOD. He is the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy, and his latest book is The Byrne Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into efforts underway to unify the Democratic Party. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include Class War, Economic Inequality, and the American Dream, and his latest is Fed Power, How Finance Wins. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you again.
And how did it strike you that after Hillary Clinton's victory speech, Bernie Sanders gave a defiant speech that he's going to carry on the fight, even though he had lost four primaries, including California?
Well, I think he's posturing in preparation for negotiation for some influence over the platform, the Democratic Party, at its convention next month, and for maybe some tinkering with the rules regarding how nominations are done in the future. But the reality here is that Hillary Clinton has won, and Bernie Sanders is laying off staff and has now gone into kind of a personal retreat. So the writing is on the wall, and I think you can already see the media shifting its lens to Clinton, Trump, with Sanders becoming yesterday's story.
So is Bernie letting down his followers easy? I mean, because they're very passionate, and it would be an absolute tragedy, I think, for American democracy if all this energy and all these young people that have flocked to his banner would be alienated and disgusted with politics, which is where they were at before Bernie showed up.
Well, I think that's a leadership challenge for Bernie Sanders and also for Hillary Clinton. It reminds me of the 1968 Democratic nomination battle in which Hubert Humphrey and Senator Gene McCarthy never were able to come together. Gene McCarthy never, you know, really gave a fulsome endorsement, and the young people and the anti-war protesters really hung back from supporting Humphrey, who then went ahead and lost in a very close race against Richard Nixon, and the history tells the story of what happened after that.
Well, I think, though, we were just speaking earlier about this with a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News about the convention in Philadelphia, and he made the point that, of course, back in the 1960s and 1970s, all conventions, Democrat and Republican, were kind of a floor fight. You know, delegations were going at it and all the way to the end. And finally, the victor emerges and gives a victory speech at the very end. And since then, in more recent decades, both Republican and Democratic conventions have largely become extended infomercials and coronations that are highly scripted.
Well, that's true. And of course, the reason for that is because of the popular backlash against the 1968 convention in which Hubert Humphrey won the nomination without running in the primaries. And there was a sense that we had to democratize the nomination process. And the result of that is that the candidates are largely selected through the caucuses and primaries that are carried over out over 3, 4, 5 months. And the result of that is, you're right, it's more of a coronation. But that is to make sure that more people get a say other than the party bosses.
Right, but the Democrats have introduced the superdelegates, which are, in effect, party bosses. And it's clearly a thorn in the side of Bernie supporters, and in many ways it is undemocratic, and there is an establishment. And of course, you've got Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a very controversial figure, running the DNC. You know, I can't imagine when she gavels the convention to order that she's not going to be booed. So it would seem to me a very ironic thing that I'm sure there will be a call for the Democrats to cut back on the number of superdelegates at the very same time that the Republicans don't have superdelegates, and many Republicans wish they did have superdelegates to stop Donald Trump.
Do you know where the superdelegates, where that originated, why that originated?
No, I don't. Tell me about it.
His name is George Wallace. George Wallace ran a quite potent campaign in 1972. And there was fear that he could have won the Democratic nomination. Now, the Democratic Party sat back, and the response to that was to create a proportion. It's about a fifth or so of the delegates who are people who are elected officials. And the idea is to bring in experience and the perspectives of a broad range of Democrats so that they could also sit in judgment. And if you had an extreme candidate like George Wallace, that candidacy would have at least some chance of being blocked. You're absolutely right that the Republicans are now looking at superdelegates as something they're going to look closely at, including precisely because they've now had their own extreme candidate seize the nomination. And as Paul Ryan says, he's a racist.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include Class War, Economic Inequality, and the American Dream. And his latest is Fed Power, How Finance Wins. Well, of course, Trump has the Republican Party in total disarray, and I find it absolutely extraordinary that somebody who appears to have run for president to improve and increase the visibility of his brand, who probably wasn't serious, has got the nomination and is now clearly out of his depth. And I don't know, do you think there's any way that, as Senator Lindsey Graham suggested a couple of days ago, that they could find an off-ramp for him? His ego is so massive, it would be difficult for him to quit because he considers himself a winner. But on the other hand, I foresee that he's going to be facing humiliation and public ridicule.
There is no way for the Republicans to shake Donald Trump. He's now got a quite large majority of the delegates, and the party is not going to walk away from its rules. The delegates who will be showing up, many of them are going to be loyal to Donald Trump. And despite Donald Trump's outrageous comments that have even been disputed by Republican leaders, I think there is a clear path for Donald Trump to win. At the end of the day, we're probably still going to see 90% of Republicans vote for him. There is a substantial number of Americans who are very frustrated and feel pained by the slow economic recovery. And Hillary Clinton is not a strong candidate. There's a lot of talk about the gender gap that Hillary Clinton has among women, but Donald Trump has an enormous gender gap in his favor among men and among whites. So this is going to be a real battle, and I would not take Donald Trump lightly. I think this is a guy who could well win. There is a path there for him.
Well, I think that political analysts are missing the fact that the Republicans have broadened their appeal under Trump. Their appeal has always, particularly the white working class men, has always been about guns and abortion and other social issues. But now Trump's broadening that base. He's already got those people because the Christian Coalition are supporting him, even though he is clearly a thrice-divorced owner of gambling dens. Why are they supporting him? Because of these trade deals and all of the appeals to, you know, stopping outsourcing and bringing back jobs and manufacturing jobs to America. So I think that Trump is actually broadened the appeal of the Republicans to working class Americans.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I say it'd be a big mistake to take Donald Trump lightly. This is a guy who may not play well with the New York Times editorial page, but he is playing well with a lot of working Americans and with Republicans and the base of the party who are frustrated with Washington and feel as if they've been forgotten.
Well, do you see Hillary Clinton, though, winning back some of these angry white men?
You know, it's possible she's going to mobilize a larger coalition. And I think when you start looking at the states, some of the key states like Florida, for instance, where there's a very large number of Hispanic voters, I think it's going to be difficult for Mr. Trump to prevail there. And there'll be some other states, including North Carolina, and much of the Southwest, including perhaps even Arizona, where Hillary Clinton's going to be able to put together this kind of multiracial coalition, much like Barack Obama. But that does not eliminate Trump's possibilities in states that Democrats have long taken for granted, including Ohio and Pennsylvania and still others. So this could well be a battle, and I think the message that Democrats are looking for Bernie Sanders to send is we've now had this battle. It's not worked out for Mr. Sanders, but there are real questions about Donald Trump winning, and that is a bigger cause.
Well, of course, but the Sanders campaign keeps saying that Bernie Sanders, according to polls, would do better against Trump.
Yeah, that is a very popular talking point, but anyone who's been in politics or followed campaigns know that's a mirage. Bernie Sanders has been entirely ignored by the Republican Party. He's not taken on the brunt of the negative advertising that Hillary Clinton has withstood for decades. Hillary Clinton, in other words, her negatives are because of that beating that Bernie Sanders would quickly get if he were the nominee. So I think his support in the polls is a bit of a mirage.
Well, it's also illogical, because if you win an election with more votes than the other person cannot argue that, well, you should give up your first place and give the prize to me because I'll beat the other guy more than you will. The world doesn't work that way, does it?
No, I think, you know, clearly in the last few weeks, Hillary Clinton has amassed such large and definitive wins in states around the country now, including the big win in California, that I think Sanders has now lost really any credibility as representing the Democratic Party. The question really is going to be about his leadership. In my view, it's will he be the next Senator McCarthy? Is this going to be a rerun of 1968? Or is he going to stand up and take responsibility for mobilizing the Democrats behind the best alternative against Donald Trump?
Well, that's pretty inflammatory to Bernie's people, suggesting he's Gene McCarthy.
I think that's the question. I'm not willing to say he's there yet, but I think that really is going to be the historic standard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for Gene McCarthy, there are a lot of people still to this day who think of him as a kind of a prince. But there were consequences to what he did and how he carried himself. And there will be the same kind of judgment of Bernie Sanders if he's unable or unwilling to mobilize against Donald Trump.
Well, I can't see Bernie Sanders having, you know, brought this huge constituency into politics, abandoning them. I mean, that surely that's the challenge, isn't it? And everybody should want him to find a way to keep those young people engaged.
Including Bernie Sanders.
Well, why wouldn't he?
Well, there's a piece today in the Washington political online newspaper called Politico that goes inside the Sanders campaign, and it reports that a lot of the animosity coming from the Sanders campaign is from Bernie Sanders himself, and that he feels personally aggrieved by how this campaign has worked out. Now, if that sense of personal aggrievement overrides the kind of historic importance of leadership at this moment, he may well make a mistake, a Gene McCarthy kind of mistake.
Well, I know the article, I read it, Inside the Bitter Last Days of Bernie's Revolution, and it is disturbing, but, you know, the sourcing and stuff, who knows? They tend to do a lot of personality stuff at Politico, along with, you know, political reporting as well. And we obviously somebody inside the campaign at a high level was the source. But just to return to the politics for a moment of the 2016 race, what does Hillary Clinton have to do then if Donald Trump's strategy to win is to win the Rust Belt? And I think that's pretty clearly the strategy that he's going to take. What does she do to hold on to the Rust Belt?
Well, I think she needs to find a way that that connects, much as Bernie Sanders has successfully done, with everyday people. And I think that tremendous liability she has as someone who's not trusted and is not considered to be honest is something she's got to work on. The solution here is not for Hillary Clinton to go where she's most comfortable, which is to run as the most qualified. That's a kind of a Michael Dukakis strategy, and it'll lead to her loss. People are looking for someone who speaks for them, and Hillary Clinton's got a long way to go.
Well, it's clearly the year of the outsider, and I don't think any status quo politician has got a hope, a prayer. I mean, people both on the left and the right, they don't want the system to be tinkered with. They think the system's broken, and it has
well,
to be
I think
fixed.
Well, those are the people on the left and the right who most participate in the primaries and caucuses. But that's only probably about 15 to 20% of the eligible voting population. So now we're going to be moving into a much broader electorate. And I think what you're going to see is Hillary Clinton trying to broaden her appeal in speaking to people in the suburbs. She's talked about, Clinton Republicans as a way to kind of try to lure over people who are alienated from Donald Trump. And as she does that, she's going to have to find a message that has that broad appeal. And that message is not, I'm better qualified than Donald Trump. That just falls flat on its face. And yet, I think we keep seeing Hillary Clinton returning to it because she feels so comfortable with that message.
Well, Lawrence Jacobs, I thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you again.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair for Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include Class War, Economic Inequality, and the American Dream, and his latest book is Fed Power, How Finance Wins. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Prime Minister Modi's visit to the White House and his address to a joint session of Congress. I have always thought that it's a crime, so I will ask you once again. Try to see it my way, only time will tell if I am right or I am wrong. Why do you see it your way? There's a chance that we might fall apart before too long. We can work it out. We can work it out. Me need the one. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. His latest book is Deadly Impasse, Indo-Pakistani Relations at the Dawn of a New Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure. And the India's Prime Minister Modi met with President Obama on Tuesday at the White House. And on Wednesday, he addressed a joint session of Congress to a great deal of applause. And my understanding is that here in the United States, I think there's a fairly uncritical approach to this controversial prime minister, and he's pretty much been uncritically accepted. But I take it in India, it's a different matter. A lot of people in India see him as being a divisive, if not dangerous, figure. So is there a disconnect there?
There is somewhat of a disconnect in that particularly minorities in India feel quite disaffected from this regime because there have been a spate of attacks on minorities, not necessarily instigated at the highest levels by any means, but Modi certainly has not shown a willingness to rein in many members of his party who have made intemperate statements, who've made provocative statements, and who have even been involved in, at least peripherally, in attacks on minorities. And consequently, many people in various minority communities are feeling quite insecure.
Well, has he not encouraged not just Hindu nationalism, but sort of Hindu fundamentalism? He himself appears to be something of a fundamentalist. I believe he's quite proud of his own celibacy, etc., and his own religiosity.
He's certainly a Hindu zealot. There's no question about it. He is a Hindu nationalist up there, and quite unabashed about that fact. But at least in office, in fairness to him, he has not said anything that could be deemed to be particularly troubling or particularly disturbing. Much of those statements, much of that rhetoric has really come from various members of his party in various states of India, and those are quite disturbing, especially in light of recent attacks on minorities, and that I find worrisome. And many people within India, not just minorities, people who are of a liberal temperament, who would like to see a democratic, secular, and plural India, are quite concerned about this climate that is emerging in India, and one that the Prime Minister is not doing much to curb.
So would it be fair to say it would be the equivalent, say, of the Reverend Pat Robertson being President of the United States?
It's not quite that bad, but because Modi's religiosity is not sort of public. I mean, it's a very personal one. I mean, he obviously has certain beliefs. He's tried to promote yoga both nationally and internationally. But what's disturbing really about Modi is some of the appointments he has made to critical positions, people whose intellectual credentials are somewhat suspect, and also who are known to be Hindu nationalists. One of the most disturbing appointments, in my judgment, that he made was to the head of the Indian Council of Historical Research, a body that disburses out considerable sums of money to scholars and to intellectuals. And this is a man who really does not have substantial credentials to his name. And he has made certain bizarre assertions about various Hindu texts and what can be inferred from these texts about how advanced India's civilization was several thousand years ago, when there is no real historical basis for these claims, especially when you are relying on Indian religious texts.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. And his latest book is Deadly Impasse, Indo-Pakistani Relations at the Dawn of a New Century. Well, on Tuesday, a bipartisan group of 18 members of the House, led by Congressman Trent Franks, a Republican of Arizona, and Betty McCollum, a Democrat of Minnesota, wrote to Paul Ryan, who had invited India's Prime Minister Modi to speak to a joint session on Wednesday. And the letter basically cited ongoing violence, harassment against religious minorities, including Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, and Sikhs. So at least there is an effort on, you know, albeit a small part of the small representation of the Congress, that at least sort of weighed in on this. But let's talk about what the substance of the White House visit was, and particularly the joint speech of the joint session. Let's start with the joint session. My understanding is that the U.S. has been trying to kind of enlist India to build up its navy in the Indian Ocean to check and balance against China's growing global reach. And although Modi talked mostly about terrorism, which obviously plays well with the Congress, since they'll write blank checks for anything that to do with terrorists. But I understand that an agreement wasn't reached on this. So what do you think Modi was trying to get out of the U.S. in terms of a defense arrangement? And what do you think the U.S. is trying to get out of Modi?
Well, Modi certainly wants a substantial American investment in India. Also in the defense sector, Modi wants to invite American investment in various forms of high technology, including in the nuclear field, and he certainly attained that. The Obama administration has really devoted some serious attention to the pivot to Asia now. And the former Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, actually had talked about India being the linchpin of this pivot. And Secretary Carter has followed up on those efforts. The major concern, that is a shared concern between India and the United States, is how will China sort of emerge in Asia, and how will it act in Asia? The signs thus far are rather disturbing, particularly with the China's attempt to create this one belt, one road, following sort of the old Silk Road, trying to integrate a whole number of countries. But along with economic integration, the Chinese influence will also spread. And of course, we have the well-worn matter of the South China Sea. China has also been rather restive on India's borders, and that has the Indians worried. The Chinese are building a major port at Gwadar in the southern Pakistani province of Balochistan. The Pakistanis have already agreed to provide facilities to the People's Liberation Army Navy once that port is built. The Chinese submarines have docked at various places in Sri Lanka. All of these are of some concern about how China is likely to flex its muscles in the Indian Ocean well beyond the South China Sea. And this factor is a common source of concern both to the United States and to India. And consequently, there's a convergence of interests here.
But I don't see the point of building up naval assets in the Indian Ocean if the Chinese are building an overland route on the Silk Road for both traffic, road traffic, and pipelines to bring oil. So obviously that port in Gwadar is very close to the China's oil supplies, which largely come from the Persian Gulf. But aren't they going to ship them overland rather than by
sea? No, I don't think they're planning on I mean, I'm sure they will to some extent, but I don't think that's going to be the sole purpose or the sole venue for shipping oil. But also it's the presence of the People's Liberation Army Navy, not just in Sri Lanka and Pakistan, as I pointed out, but also the naval visits to Bangladesh, the presence there, already a substantial presence in Burma, in Myanmar, depending on how one refers to that country. So there is a growing PLA Navy presence in the Indian Ocean. And that, of course, is of concern to India and of concern to the United States. And that's where there's an overlapping set of interests between India and the United States.
Well, the other overlapping set of interests, apart from terrorism, which Modi discussed at length in his joint address to the Congress, is Afghanistan. And India is obviously quite involved trying to help stabilize Afghanistan. But at the same time, anything the Indians do in Afghanistan absolutely freaks out the Pakistanis. They're totally paranoid about it. So what's your understanding of what could be done on the part of India? And I know they have a close relationship with Iran, and there's a road that goes all the way from the Indian Ocean all the way up to Herat, which is the Shia part of Afghanistan on the border with Iran. So how can they navigate that? Because obviously I think Pakistan, the US must recognize how fragile Afghanistan is and what a pernicious role Pakistan has been playing all along. At the same time, how does India help stabilize Afghanistan when their mere presence there drives the Pakistanis up the wall?
Well, as you correctly pointed out, Pakistan's role in Afghanistan has been downright disingenuous and pernicious. And very belatedly, the United States, decision makers in the United States, have come to the reluctant conclusion that no amount of incentives will get Pakistan to change its behavior. Pakistan has taken American weaponry, has taken significant amounts of money to the tune of $30 billion since this global war on terror started, and has done pitiably little in terms of helping the United States out in Afghanistan. Some of us warned about this quite earlier, but we were sort of dismissed out of hand, and our arguments were not taken seriously. Rather belatedly, this administration has come to the realization, and only a partial realization, that simply providing various kinds of inducements to Pakistan is not going to really ultimately change its behavior and get it to abandon its support for people like Gulbuddin Hikmatyar or members of the Haqqani network. And the Pakistanis make a great deal of hue and cry about the Indian presence in Afghanistan. But if one looks more closely and dispassionately at the Indian presence in Afghanistan, the Pakistan really has very little to be concerned about. What have the Indians done? They are the fifth largest aid donor to Afghanistan. At one point, a senior American officials conceded that its aid was about the most effective in terms of actually reaching the intended recipients. It has rebuilt the Afghan parliament. It has built roadways. It has repaired an electronic grid. It has provided high-quality protein biscuits to Afghan children for lunch. And only very tentatively have the Indians sold a bunch of Soviet-era helicopter gunships to Afghanistan. They have refused to station troops in Afghanistan. They have only trained Afghan bureaucrats in India. I had suggested in an op-ed in the Asian Wall Street Journal several years ago that India should train the Afghan National Army because it has plenty of spare capacity in its bases. So if one looks at the bundle of Indian investments and the Indian actions, there is little cause for Pakistan's concern. This is a drum that the Pakistani ISI and the military establishment has been very effectively beating in an attempt to paint India as a potentially destabilizing and threatening force. And if one looks at the evidence and sifts through the evidence a bit more closely, it becomes crystal clear that there is nothing inimical about the Indian presence in Afghanistan.
Well, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, frankly, when you say that Pakistan's role with the United States has been pernicious, I think it's worse than that. I think you can actually make the case that every American who lost a father, son, or a daughter in Afghanistan, the blood is on the hands of the Pakistanis because they sheltered, they trained, and they supplied and equipped the Taliban and Haqqani and all of their surrogates. And without that, you know, most of the deaths from those IEDs, which was the ANFO, was supplied by Pakistan. I mean, it's crazy that we put up with it as long as we did. But let's not dwell on that. I just wanted to finish up with what happened at the White House with Obama and Prime Minister Modi. They talked a lot about India joining the Paris Climate Change Accords. Interesting enough, in before the joint session of Congress, of course, when Modi said that he would help ensure security of the sea lanes and freedom of navigation at sea, but also when he referred to the climate change summit, the Democrats leapt to their feet and cheered, but the Republicans sat silent. And there you have our divided and dysfunctional Congress on display.
Yes, that is exactly right. And what is particularly amusing is that Modi had obviously been briefed very carefully by his aides, because he made a couple of tart remarks about how the Congress is known for bipartisanship and how it's such a harmonious body. So Modi was well aware of this deeply divided audience that he was speaking to. His position on the Paris Accords is actually quite a bold position, because India has substantial coal-fired plants. India produces substantial amounts of bituminous coal, which is highly polluting, and it is not going to be like the matter of flipping a switch to enable India to transition from the use of coal-fired furnaces and plants and move towards nuclear power and move towards solar power, even though it's making significant investments in both. But nevertheless, this is going to be a gradual process. And so Modi has quite an uphill task ahead of him in terms of ensuring that India makes a good faith effort to meet the targets of Paris.
Well, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. And his latest book is Deadly Impasse, Indo-Pakistani Relations at the Dawn of a New Century. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.